The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've survived the blizzard of 2019 here in Edmond, Oklahoma. A little bit of an exaggeration there, but if the meteorologists can do it, so can we. A little bit of snow left over from yesterday's storm. I think the temperature right now is about 32 degrees, and it's supposed to warm up today, so probably lots of slushy conditions throughout the day, but it might be a little bit slick as you head out for work here in central Oklahoma. I think our signal's down for the broadcast here locally, but hopefully the stream is up and running for those of you that listen to the live stream around the world. On today's show, we're going to, in the second segment, we're going to continue with our study, a reminder of that 40 years, the anniversary of that that attack, the state of California's attack on Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God. Today, we'll focus more on why God allowed this to happen back in 1979. And we'll also look at how Satan attacks or persecutes God's church. There's lots of takeaways from this history. And we know, as we've said so often before, that history repeats itself. So it's not something that we should be surprised by when it does happen. Here in the United States, it's I guess it's off and running following all of the traditions and customs of men over these winter weeks. The incoming Congress, the new Democrat-controlled Congress, coming into power yesterday, Nancy Pelosi taking over her position, her new position as the House Speaker. And she told the USA Today that Donald Trump, President Trump, can expect a different world. And then you have all of these Democrats already coming forward with this sham legislation to impeach President Trump or to fund the government, but not the border wall. Of course, the partial government shutdown continues on into its 13th or 14th day, I think. And as I say, some of the Dems last night passed legislation that's never going to work its way through the Senate. And so they're just doing it to make a statement. Here's the funding, but nothing, they keep stressing, for the border wall. The National Interest made, a good point this morning regarding the partial government shutdown, saying how that this shows us just how massive the federal government is and that it should be smaller. I guess the partial government shutdown affects 850,000 so-called non-essential employees. How about that if you're an American paying taxes? Lots and lots of taxes every year. And then you come to find out that there's 850,000, almost a million non-essential employees. There's the essential employees, and they're still working. All of that's fully funded. But there's nearly a million that the government supports, pays, employs, and they're categorized as non-essential. They're not really that important, but we've got nearly a million of those positions anyway. So there's that. There's all the gyrations in the stock market. That's getting quite a lot of news as well, up and down over the last couple of months. But leaving all of that aside, as Victor Davis Hanson says in his column at National Review, 2018 was actually a pretty good year for America. He says the United States remains the largest producer of natural gas and the second greatest producer of coal. He says the scary old energy-related phraseology of the last half century, energy crisis, peak oil embargo, no longer exists. You don't even hear those terms, those phrases anymore. He says near total energy self-sufficiency means that the U.S. is no longer strategically manipulated by the Middle East. And the gas prices, I think it's well under $2, at least here in central Oklahoma. Probably some of the cheapest costs for fuel in the world. A lot cheaper than the U.K. and Europe, where it's more like $7, $8 per gallon. He says the American economy grew by 4.2% in the second quarter last year. It was 3.4% in the third quarter, something that Obama and all of his people said would never happen. And President Trump and other factors, I'm sure, they've made it happen. American GDP is nearly $1.7 trillion larger than in January 2017. 2 years ago, that's when President Trump, of course, came into office. We're coming up on a lot of anniversaries next week and the week after. We'll talk more about that. But he's been in office nearly 2 years, and the GDP is nearly $1.7 trillion larger than it was just 2 years ago. America's GDP is nearly $8 trillion larger than the GDP of China. We hear so much about China, the emerging power coming out of Asia, and yet still, comparatively, look at the size of America's economy. The unemployment figures were at a near record peacetime low at 3.7% unemployment. Think about all those years during President Obama, and the millions and millions of people that were added to the food stamp rolls. It says the poverty rate is at a near historic low. The household income has increased. There are about 8 million fewer Americans living below the poverty line than there were 8 years ago. Since January of 2017, that's when President Trump came into office, it says more than 3 million Americans have gone off so-called food stamps. And then he gets into a number of other things, a number of bad things that were supposed to happen, but have not happened. He's describing a temporary resurgence. Well, he doesn't see it as temporary, but we do. But that's what he's describing there. The temporary resurgence of the United States. Well, that doesn't mean so many of these other prophecies are not going to be fulfilled. In fact, as we've covered, the temporary resurgence itself is a prophecy. But then you look at some of the other things happening around the world. The statement that the president made, I think it was Tuesday, about Iran, saying that they're feeling the pinch. They're being hurt, and this is a different country. It's no longer the same country. They're pulling people out of Syria, the president said. And I'm not so sure about that, but in the midst of his statement, he said that Iran can frankly do whatever it wants in Syria. That's quite a statement. With the U.S. on the way out, and then the sitting president of the United States saying, Iran can do what it wants. Well, I don't care. I don't care what happens. He justifies it by saying, well, they're moving out. They're moving out of Yemen anyway, so what's the big deal? We need to get our boys out. That certainly falls right in line with prophecies regarding the King of the South, Psalm 83, Daniel 11. And we've been keeping our eyes on that for quite some time. There was a piece at the Berlin Policy Journal, I think an interview with Ben Rhodes from the Obama administration. He told the Berlin Policy Journal that President Trump is hostile to Europe. So there's the Obama people out there trying to sow discord, trying to cause division. There's no doubt, of course, that the tone and the relationship between the United States and Europe is certainly different than it once was. But the president has his enemies abroad, and he has plenty of them at home, as we well know. There's quite a few stories, too, about just how 2018 was the year of just this obvious and blatant media bias. One story here from The Wrap, which says that an NBC News veteran, he's leaving the work because he feels like the network is a prisoner to Donald Trump. This guy, I guess his name is Bill Arkin, he sends off this 2,000-word internal memo saying that we're being held hostage to the President Trump news cycle. And there's some truth to that, as I keep saying when I'm broadcasting from over at Edstone. This is all that the American news cycle fixates on. It's just all things Donald Trump. From this guy's memo, it says, "The world and the state of journalism is in tandem crisis, and I find myself completely out of sync with the network, being neither a day-to-day reporter nor interested in the Trump circus. In our day-to-day whirlwind and hostage status as prisoners of Donald Trump, I think, like everyone else does, that we miss so much. We miss so much." These are reporters. These are administrators at these networks. Left-wingers. And even they are coming out and admitting, this is ridiculous what we're doing. We're destroying our credibility. What's left of it? The former New York Times editor, she was the veteran journalist for the paper between 2011 and 2014, just a few years ago. And she said that the New York Times, her old paper, have become, the people working there have become unmistakably anti-Trump. That's a direct quote. Unmistakably anti-Trump. And she said this imbalance is helping to erode the credibility of the New York Times. So here are two journalists from the top of those organizations, NBC and the New York Times, acknowledging what to many people is quite obvious. Speaking of media bias, you remember that story from a couple of weeks ago, the reporter at Der Spiegel who was making up all of these stories about America and small American towns, anything and everything to just make America look horrible. And a story at The Atlantic says that this was driven by anti-Americanism, which is kind of an obvious point. But the fact that this guy was able to stay there for so long, printing all of his errors, is because of this anti-American bias. It runs deep in Der Spiegel. And this article talks about that particular case, but then also just some of the ways that it's reported on America and the last presidential election and some of the covers that it's shown. I guess I won't take the time to get into it. But you certainly do see this hostility toward the United States coming from Germany. Der Spiegel, of course, is the leading German publication. The leading German news publication. Lee Smith had a great piece at The Federalist. Here again, just talking about not even just the bias in the media, but the lies and the fake news, as the president often says. He's writing here about the Steele dossier and pointing out how that the dossier plays such a central role in this ongoing investigation, the Bob Mueller probe. And how that the dossier, as you know, it's all based on lies. It was just a series of memos. He says here that the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, he's the one that set out the parameters for Robert Mueller. This is what we want you to investigate. And so there's this two-page document that came out that summarized the Steele dossier. You'll remember Jim Comey when he talked to or briefed President Trump on January 6th in 2017. He had this two-page document that paraphrased some of the content that was in that series of memos that's been since called the dossier. But it says here, in the unredacted portions of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein's memo outlining Mueller's scope, so this is another memo where Rosenstein is talking about these are the boundaries for Mueller, and so that's been made known, or at least there's some unredacted portions that are now known. It says, outlining Mueller's scope are allegations that Trump advisor Paul Manafort colluded with Russian government officials interfering in the 2016 race. And Lee Smith says here that that claim is found in no other known document but the dossier. So you know about the dossier and how that it was used to get those warrants to spy on Carter Page and all of his Trump associates. And you know about the dossier and how that Jim Comey and CNN and Clapper and all those guys, they colluded. They needed the news hook, remember? And so they briefed the president on this on January 6th. And then CNN, they got the news hook and they ran with the story and BuzzFeed printed off all the memos. But then you advance further into the year, 2017, I mean, and here is Rod Rosenstein. Once that special counsel was appointed, he's giving the parameters and he's basing it on the dossier. This document that's been thoroughly discredited. That's how this investigation continues. That's the basis for which you have Democrats now coming forward saying, we're going to impeach him the first day for this new Congress. And here come these Democrats. And it's all based on this. It's all based on these lies. It says the dossier operation has not only damaged institutions like the FBI and DOJ, it has also positioned, or rather poisoned, the public sphere, perhaps irremediably, there's a word I need to look up. It says, as a result, it is now accepted journalistic practice to print and reprint any garish fantasy, so long as it's layered with Russian intrigue and Trump team treason. See, this really does tie in with some of these other stories that I just mentioned. These reporters that are leaving their organizations, or former employees, or former reporters for New York Times, in the case of Jill Abrahamson, who are saying it's so unmistakably anti-Trump. Or in the case of that NBC veteran, it's so obsessed with Donald Trump, we're missing all these other news stories. It says here, how did it come to this? Former FBI Director James Comey ushered in the era of the dossier when he briefed President Trump on January 6th, 2017, on reports that the Russians allegedly had tapes involving him and prostitutes at the presidential suite at the Ritz-Carlton in Moscow from about 2013. That was in the very first memo, June of 2016. And then there were 17, I think, in total, that last half of 2016. All of this nonsense, all of this garbage. But the FBI director then at the time, he goes to the president and says, just so you know, there are some reports of this, this, and this. The president says, well, that's ridiculous. And then Clapper leaks it to CNN, the organization that later hires him. And it continues. No one puts a stop to the nonsense. Even after the lies are exposed, fully exposed, no one comes out to apologize. The investigation continues. The articles of impeachment, they're in the works. They're still being drawn up. It says, as Comey later recorded in a separate memorandum documenting the meeting, he told Trump that that media like CNN have the reports and were looking for a news hook. The briefing provided one. Comey's briefing with President Trump. It was the news hook. It was all a setup from the beginning. That we now know. It's so obvious. It says, according to intelligence officials, the fact that Page, this is speaking of Carter Page, was relatively unknown made him an attractive target. They went after him because, well, you can go before a FISA judge, and if it's someone more prominent, the judge might be skeptical. Well, hang on a second. You can't just get a search warrant or wiretap someone like that. But they waltz into court and say, well, it's this lesser-known Carter Page, and do you know how many times he's been to Russia? And he's got all these connections? And now he's on the Trump campaign. And so the FISA judges signed off on it, which they almost always do, because they trust the government. They trust the FBI and the DOJ. They think that those institutions, that they're coming in seeking the truth. That they're not driven by political agendas. Lawlessness. It's a total breakdown of law and order. It says here, finally, it can be tougher to make a FISA case on a prominent government-connected figure, said former Army intelligence officer Chris Farrell. But you can spin a tale about a guy who is on the margins. You can make sweeping generalizations. You don't have to be too detailed. And they'd use the lack of information on Page to explain that's precisely why they need the warrant, so that they can learn more about him. That's what they say. In fact, as we know, in fact, their target, their real target, is and has been and always will be Donald Trump. When we come back, we'll continue our study from yesterday, just passing the 40-year anniversary of the state of California's attack on Herbert Armstrong and the Worldwide Church of God. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily.
Yesterday's program, it's posted at thetrumpet.com, by the way, Herbert W. Armstrong's Finest Hour. And we got some nice response to that particular show. One here from New Jersey says, your Trumpet Daily today was a walk down memory lane for me. Back in 1979, on hearing about the receivership, I remember going immediately to our bank and stopping the tithe check we had just mailed to Pasadena, and then writing out another check to Mr. Armstrong and mailing it to Tucson, Arizona. My husband and I watched national TV news about the event for several nights. Surprising to us, one of those dissidents was actually someone right from our congregation here in New Jersey, someone that we knew well. He talks about, or she talks about rather, that attack and what led up to it, Garner Ted Armstrong. Mr. Armstrong's son, telling his father that he would destroy him. And then he was disfellowshipped, put out of the church, and that's what triggered it all. I'll get to that in just a moment. But another individual here, our listener, says, great program of our glorious history. It says, thank you for explaining it. This is referring to yesterday's show. Thank you for explaining it in great depth and detail. Outstanding. We can't forget our wonderful history. By the way, I was one of those blessings after the court case, speaking of that lawsuit in 1979. He says, God began calling me in 1978, and I was baptized in 1980. So quite a few of our listeners very familiar with that history. And if you're not as familiar with it, as I say, go back and listen to that show from yesterday, Herbert W. Armstrong's Finest Hour. Well, going back to Garner Ted Armstrong and his disfellowshipment, Mr. Armstrong, the senior, he wrote in June of 1979, I quoted excerpts from this yesterday, but he talked about his heart failure in 1977 and how that the church there in the late 70s, it was in really bad shape, the Worldwide Church of God. Spiritually speaking, it was a sick church, sick and infirmed spiritually. And Mr. Armstrong was traveling the world something like 300 days a year, so he wasn't in Pasadena that often. And then the authority that he had delegated to his son, it was being abused. And the church was turning into this secular, worldly organization. Mr. Armstrong, the senior, he was cut off. And so in June of 1978, this is before the litigation, before the state came in on January 3rd, 1979, to try to take over the Worldwide Church of God. 6 months before that, Mr. Armstrong disfellowshipped Garner Ted Armstrong, and that action, kicking him out of the church, that action is what triggered this shameful conspiracy. And then the lawsuit, the attack by the state of California, all brought on by a half dozen disgruntled members, as I said yesterday. That's all that it took. And then here comes the state of California waltzing into the Worldwide Church of God on January 3rd, 1979. As soon as that happened, Stanley Rader, he's the one that wrote the book Against the Gates of Hell, he called Herbert Armstrong in Tucson right away. And then after that, he was talking to him on the phone about every hour, keeping him updated. And Rader said about Mr. Armstrong, problems have never upset Mr. Armstrong, and he reacted even to this serious threat with serenity, courage, and confidence. And then this from the quote I gave to you yesterday. He says, over the years of my close association with this remarkable man, I have noted abundant evidence that he is the embodiment of his own message of hope and trust that the living God will provide man with the wisdom to prevail over obstacles. He says that he was certain that as he gave the news to Mr. Armstrong, that Mr. Armstrong then proceeded to kneel down in the quietness of his private prayer room to seek God's counsel, to seek God's guidance, to seek God's deliverance. And then Stan Rader said this in his book, the damage that appointment of a receiver can do to any organization, and most especially a church, cannot be overestimated. It is as though a perfectly respectable individual were falsely arrested on a charge of sexual misconduct. Until the accused can prove his innocence through the laborious machinery of the law, a reputation built up layer by layer over the years has been blackened and virtually destroyed. That's what happened to the church. Its reputation blackened and nearly destroyed in a moment with all these false accusations, these scurrilous charges. Listen to what Mr. Armstrong was saying in a sermon. This is about a year after the state's attack on the church. Clip one.
And the state of California came and provoked this lawsuit. Now, mark you, it was a lawsuit. It was not a case of charging us or arresting us on a charge to be imprisoned for anything wrong. We were not accused of any wrongdoing whatsoever by the state. But the ones who convinced the state to bring the suit went to the papers and the newspapers, and news on television spread this thing that we had sold so many million dollars, as Mr. Rader said in the beginning of this program today.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1980, saying that there were no charges. There was no evidence of crime. There were just these scandalous allegations brought on by six malcontents. And the state, they come in there looking for crimes. Some eerie similarities to some of the things you see happening today with America's government. In the book, Against the Gates of Hell, Stan Rader says, "Sensational news travels fast and merits black headlines and prime spots on the evening news. If an accusation is made, the vast majority of readers and viewers tend to accept it." We need to remember this. When this happens again, just be forewarned. Be prepared for what's coming. The vast majority of people, they just tend to accept it. They believe it. It says, in the case of a receivership, moreover, the presumption of guilt created by the court's order is powerful. Few people asked, what is the other side's case? Rather, they infer that if the court has been forced to act, something very serious must be afoot. That's what a lot of people assume, just to, again, refer back to the political scene today. Well, if the court gave the warrant, this must be serious. Well, what about the other side? What do they have to say? Where's the evidence of wrongdoing? Rader says here, in just 2 days, we were to reap the first bitter fruits. Headlines throughout the country trumpeted the news that a church was being rocked by a financial scandal so massive, so shocking, that the state of California had been forced to step in. They stepped in because of what Garner Ted Armstrong and those dissidents said. That's it. There was nothing wrong with the church. Well, it wasn't receiving the blessings that it had in the 60s. That's another point. We'll come to that in a second. But there was no wrongdoing going on. There certainly was no criminality. The church wasn't being as blessed as it once was, but those blessings were about to pour forth once again. The moment Herbert Armstrong stood up to this outrageous attack, it says, and if people missed the headlines, they heard and saw it on television. Camera crews and newsmen descended on the church in droves. The name Worldwide Church was being blackened before it had been given a chance to say a word in its defense. This is the way it works. Even in the United States of America, with its powerful media, with the Department of Justice, all of these federal prosecutors, read Habakkuk 1, the entire chapter there. We went through that when we were going through our lawsuit with the Worldwide Church of God. There's no judgment or justice in the land. That's prophesied. But to come back to this persecution brought on by the devil in 1979, here again, think about the way that the devil works. And consider, if you're in God's true church, consider who you are and how big of a target you are. Jesus said, they shall put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time comes that whosoever kills you will think that he does God's service. And these things will they do unto you, because they have not known the Father nor me. Satan's always trying to destroy the work of God. There is no bigger target in Satan's eyes than this church, than God's church, God's work. Mr. Armstrong wrote back in 1972, this was several years before California's attack on the church, but he said this wouldn't be the very work of God unless it was being persecuted. Our persecutors themselves prove this. is the very work of God. We do not invite persecution. We try to avoid it. But the living Christ in your Bible says we will get persecution and false accusation. In this world, we have to expect it. We have to expect, at the best, careless journalism, and at the worst, irresponsible journalism. That's in 1972. That's Herbert Armstrong writing in 1972, almost 50 years ago. And look at where media, look at where they are today. You have even top administrators or journalists at NBC and the New York Times saying, you know what, this is ridiculous what's happened. We have lost our credibility. We're unmistakably biased. You look at those accusations brought against Mr. Armstrong. We went through some of this yesterday, that he was siphoning off all these millions and millions of dollars from the sales of some properties that they were selling at that time, the church selling off properties, and somehow the money was being just packed into Mr. Armstrong's pockets. He would have had to be colluding with about 20 people to make that happen. We're talking about scandalous behavior. Nothing like that ever happened. There was never any evidence of that. The state never had it. Garner Ted never had it. None of those dissidents had that kind of evidence. They just waltzed in there on these trumped up charges. In John 17, in verse 14, Jesus' prayer there at Passover, he said, I've given them your word, and the world has hated you because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. They hate God's people, God's church, because we're not of the world. We're to come out of this world. That 1972 letter, Mr. Armstrong says, this very persecution inspires us to go forward. It inspires us because we know it's prophesied, because Jesus told us this would happen. It inspires us to go forward with renewed enthusiasm, faith, and determination. Our God is still on his throne. The living Christ will never leave us nor forsake us. God was with Mr. Armstrong. He's the one who inspired the move to Tucson just a few months before this attack happened, and that made it possible for him to be shielded from all of this. And he could direct the work from Arizona. He could tell the brethren through that phone network. He could tell the brethren, don't send your tithes to Pasadena. There's a receiver there who's taking over the church, and he says, I'm fired. Well, we'll show him what God says. We'll show him a little bit of something about the character of this church and the backbone that we have, spiritually speaking. And so a lot of members started doing with what that one listener said in her email, going to the bank, stopping the payment to Pasadena and redirecting it to Tucson, Arizona. That same sermon that Mr. Armstrong gave a year after the attack. Notice what he went on to say. This is clip two.
But first, 1 year ago, day before yesterday, Satan launched his most massive blow up to date to destroy the work of the supreme almighty God by the massive invasion of the legal arm of the largest state in the United States, the state of California. Now Jesus said, if they have persecuted me, they will persecute you. I have known all along that we were destined to be persecuted. And I wonder if you realize that it is nearly always the power of human government that the governments of this world have set up that are the persecutors of God and the work of God, and it has been that way for 6,000 years. Soldiers of the Roman government crucified Jesus Christ. Of course, the pressure was brought on them from the Pharisees, who were in the lower echelon of under the Roman government and serving the government, and they had demanded his crucifixion.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1980. those comments coming a year after the state attacked the church. But as he said there, it's nearly always the power of human government, the human government of this world, that brings persecution on the church of God. Now, you think about that prophecy in Amos 7, where Amaziah tells God's servant and God's people to leave, to get out. Don't prophesy here anymore. You go over to Judah and prophesy there. Think about that persecution from 1979 and Amaziah's work there in Amos 7. Another prophecy, his work with Jeroboam, a king, a leader, human government. Satan is filled with wrath, and he's quite capable, as we've seen even with politics in the United States, he's quite capable of creating an echo chamber, of bringing forward angry dissidents, those that have been cast out or disfellowship, malcontents, those that hate their political enemies. And then they create this false narrative, these scurrilous allegations, scandalous rumors, gossip. Revelation 12 says Satan is the accuser of our brethren. He accuses night and day. He's the one that was behind that attack in 1979. Over in 2 Timothy 3, verse 10, Paul says to his servant Timothy, "But you have fully known my doctrine, manner of life, purpose, faith, long-suffering, charity, patience, persecutions, afflictions, which came unto me at Antioch, at Iconium, at Lystra, what persecutions I endured. But out of them all, the Lord delivered me." God, he took care of the Apostle Paul. He protected him. It's not that Paul never died. He was persecuted at the very last as well, when he was executed. But Paul went on to say here in verse 12, "Yes, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution." If you're living godly lives, if you're living the way God says to live, you are going to be persecuted. This is nothing new for the people of God. It's happened in history. It happened in 1979. And just know, the previous chapter, by the way, 2 Timothy 2:12, it says, "If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will also deny us." If we suffer with him, we reign with Jesus Christ. The Bible, it doesn't promise smooth sailing for true Christians. It doesn't promise a life of idleness and ease. "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Eternal delivers them out of them all." Acts 14 and verse 22, it says, "We must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God." So sooner or later, it does come upon the people of God, and we don't want to bring it upon ourselves. We, as Mr. Armstrong says, we strive to do everything we can to avoid it, but we also need to know who we are, and we need to go to God right away when it comes, so that we know how to answer it, how to respond to it. In the case of 1979, as I said on yesterday's show, you had this inspiring response from Herbert Armstrong saying, "Look, we're standing firm. This is unconstitutional. They're violating the laws of this land." Now, I know they don't care about God's law. I'm not going to go and preach to them about God's law. But let's talk about the Constitution. Let's talk about the free exercise of religion. He defended himself. And he said, if some of us need to go to jail, I'll be the first to go. And then you look at the membership in the church. All of these brethren redirecting their tithes. And then 3 weeks into it, just spontaneously showing up at Pasadena and filling up the Hall of Ad and the auditorium and the student center. All these buildings on campus. And then Mr. Armstrong running all of those full-page ads in newspapers all across California and even some national papers. I played this quote for you yesterday. This is Mr. Armstrong when he was at SEP saying that we're going to fight back and we're going to hold them to account what they've done to us. This is clip three.
This is a case of where the government is the villain and is doing the wrong thing. And we're not going to let them get away with it. We're not going to let the... They would like to get off the hook right now. They realize that they attacked the wrong people. They know now they made a great mistake. And they'd like to get off the hook, so to speak, but we're not going to let them off the hook. And they're going to rue the day that they ever started trying to destroy the work and the church of the living God. Because that's what they did.
That's from July 1979. They attacked the wrong people. He fought back, and the state of California dropped the suit the following year. And then there was the legislation, as I said yesterday, that that prevented this kind of thing from ever happening again. Because Mr. Armstrong stood firm. He stood up for the Constitution. Well, why did God allow this to happen? What good could possibly come from an attack like this? Here is a state, the biggest state in the Union, attacking this little church. Well, I mentioned the 1970s, that decade, it wasn't so great for the church. As Mr. Armstrong wrote in 1979, he said the church a year ago, it was in bad shape spiritually. And we needed this. In fact, we needed this attack. This is what he wrote in January, January 18th, 1979. I read from some of this yesterday. But he's talking here about why God would allow this to happen. He says, first, to wake us up spiritually and to bring us back close to him. And second, to draw us closer together. And third, to sift out from our midst some of the chaff from the wheat. So here are some of the benefits, the blessings. This is bringing us closer to God. This is bringing us closer to each other. And furthermore, if there are tares or wolves in our midst, this will sift them out. And so it'll bring unity and health and togetherness and love and joy and peace to the church of God. You look at what it did even to Mr. Armstrong. It revitalized him. He's coming off of heart failure in 1977. And they were saying in this litigation, oh, he's senile. And as I read to you yesterday, well, if I'm senile, look at what I'm doing here. Look at how I'm fighting back. This is not the work of a senile old man. God empowered him. God backed him. I played excerpts yesterday from that special World Tomorrow program from 1979. And here's another bit. This is Mr. Armstrong talking in that exchange with Art Gilmore, clip four.
And God is going to win this victory because it is a challenge against God. Now, God is going to let it go to the point that he wants it to go to. The first thing I begin to ask is, where am I wrong? Where is the church wrong? What have we done that God allows this thing to come on us? And when I wrote to all of our members all over the world, I said we need to realize this could not have happened if God did not allow it. God did not cause it, but he allowed it. And it's a kind of punishment.
That's Herbert Armstrong from 1979. What a valuable lesson there is in this. This, he stood up, he stood firm. He defended the church. He took action. But you can see the attitude and the mindset that he had when he went before God. God, you've allowed this. Why has this come upon us? Why did you allow this? And what are we supposed to learn from this? He looked at himself. He looked at the church. He went to God for answers, for direction. God, show me. Show us what we need to learn. Help us to understand why we're going through this trial so that we can learn the lessons that we need to learn from it. Well, as he explained in that January 5th, 1980 sermon, God allowed it because the church had gone to sleep. The church needed to wake up spiritually. Here again is what he said a year after the attack, clip 5.
Most of us have been asleep, and we need to wake up. Now, this church has been turned around in the last year. The doctrines have been restored. The truth has been restored that secular ministers were trying to do away with. Many of the ministers have been put out of the church that were secular and that were liberal and wanted to water down the truth of God. And we're going back to the old ways unto the truth of God. And God is blessing this church. Satan is angry, and he's tried to bring the wrath of the greatest state and the biggest state in the whole United States to try to destroy us. They haven't destroyed us. We've had an increase in income this year. The membership has gone up, and the people of God are united. And let me tell you, where the worst area in all the world of the Church of God was Pasadena, where the headquarters are supposed to be located. Actually, the headquarters are right here where I'm speaking to you right now, in my own home here in Tucson, Arizona. But it had gotten down where people hardly ever would come to a Bible study, and they wanted to do away with it altogether. Now they're so interested, they want to know more of the Word of God. It's time to wake up and get back and know what is being told us in the Word of God, and that we get on our knees a little bit more and get a little bit closer to God and a little bit farther away from the cares and the enjoyments and the pleasures of this world.
See, when you come out of this world and draw closer to God, and when the true doctrines of the Bible are restored to the church, and when the secular anti-God ministers are put out of the church, and then the income for the church increases, and the membership figures increase, the circulation increases for the plain truth. These are blessings. This is why God allowed it to happen. The donation income for the Worldwide Church of God throughout the 70s, it hovered at about $50 million. In 1972, it was $50 million. In 1978, it was about $50 million. So because of inflation, I mean, it was actually going down. They were losing income. And what was the total donations? Tithes and offerings in 1986, the year that Herbert Armstrong died? Not $50 million. Not $75 million. Not $100 million. It was $133 million. And that's just the tithes and donations. There were other sources of income that put it much higher than that even. But just by comparison, look at the blessings. Around the same time as that sermon I just played for you, Mr. Armstrong wrote in January of 1980, he said, 1 year ago today, Satan launched his most devastating attempt to destroy this work of the living God, including the plain truth, Ambassador College, the Worldwide Church of God, and the Ambassador International Cultural Foundation. He says, I want to tell you the real significance of that massive attack by the Attorney General's Office of the State of California and how God has spared this work and kept it going and growing. He kept it going and growing. He says, actually, God has blessed us so that the income for carrying on the work of God has continued and has shown enough increase through 1979 to offset inflation. And he goes on and talks about so many of the other blessings that God had been pouring down upon the church. A wonderful, wonderful lesson or takeaway from that history. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.